All important election returns received at the NBC newsroom will be broadcast throughout this program.
Information, please. Presented at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts and enjoy a glass of refreshing Canada Dry ginger ale. At this time, Canada Dry stages its question and answer party in which the American public joins. Here's how it goes. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. And if your question stumps off, you get $10 more, but in addition you receive a complete 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Mind you, this is only if your question stumps our board of experts. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was received first. All questions become the property of Information Please. Before I present our Master of Ceremonies, may I request you specially to keep tuned in to the very end of this program, at which time an important announcement regarding it will be made. And now, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine and Grand Inquisitor of Information Please, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please will continue as usual, as a spontaneous and unrehearsed program. Tonight marks something in the way of a reunion meeting for our Information Please authorities. If you keep tuned in, we'll tell you what it's all about later on. Our tried and true trio, try that on your triller, is here in full strength this evening. Oscar Levant, musician, Franklin P. Adams, columnist, John Kieran, sportsman, and amateur scientist. Our guest is no stranger. This marks his 11th appearance on Information Please, which makes him a kind of grand old man of guest experts. I refer to no other than Christopher Morley, the author of Kitty Foyle and of The Trojan Horse, the play currently running at the Mill Pond Playhouse, Roslyn, Long Island. Remember, listeners, for each question that's missed, Canada Dry rings up $10, and that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the latest edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Suppose we start the ceremonies this evening with a question from Mrs. H. L. Wheeler of Buffalo. Gentlemen, without asking you to recall the words in which you, each of you, proposed to your own wife or wives, I shall ask you who proposed to whom in the following words. There are three sets of words. Identify two out of three. First, quote, I'm young, I'm a swell conversationalist, and I've got a chance to be president, close quote. Who proposed to whom in those words?
Once more.
I'm young, comma, Mr. Levant. I'm a swell conversationalist, comma, and I've got a chance to be president. Mm. Mr. Levant.
I think I that was Wintergreen.
You bet. In what play?
Of Thee I Sing.
Of Thee I Sing.
He was a Democrat in those days. He would be a Republican now.
Well, that's possible. It's
because
possible.
Maury Riskin wrote of Thee I Sing. It was against the Republican regime. Now Louisiana Purchase, which he co-authored, is against the Democrat regime. So,
that makes it even. Yeah. And to whom did John P. Wintergreen propose in the play?
Her real name was Moran, her last name.
You don't care
Mary,
about...
No, Mary Turner.
Mary Turner, yes. That's right. In Of Thee I Sing. That's quite right. Now the second proposal. For years I have loved you with a white-hot passion that is slowly but surely consuming my very vitals. Mr. Adams.
Coco proposes to Caddyshaw.
Yes, in what play?
In The Mikado.
Any luck? I mean, what's the proposal?
Well, he got her.
He got her. That's playing safe. That's quite right, Mr. Adams. Now, third and last. I mean, your eyes, they shine like the pants of a blue serge suit. Mr. Morley.
It sounds like O. Henry.
No, it isn't, though, Mr. Adams.
Sounds like the Marx Brothers.
Not all of them.
It sounds like Groucho Marx.
Yes, it sounds like Groucho Marx.
In what I don't know in almost anything.
Almost anything. Could you identify it for us, Mr. Levant?
Well, it's either animal crackers or coconuts.
The coconuts is right. It's Groucho Marx, whose name in the play or movie is Hammer, proposing to Mrs. Potter. Well, that gives us two out of three, with Mr. Morley coming up and making a tiny, tiny fanning out at bat there, but we finally got through. And sending us on to the next question from Edward Wilheim of Brooklyn, New York. Get three out of four on this if you can, gentlemen. What is the plural? This is a very simple question. What is the plural of the following words or expressions? The first, Lord Justice. The plural of Lord Justice. You've got to get this right the first time, gentlemen. Lord Justice. Mr. Adams.
Lord's Justice.
That's wrong. That's what I would have said, Mr. Adams.
I was going to say the other.
What were you going to say, Mr. Levant?
Lord Justices.
That was wrong, too.
How about Lords Justices?
Now you've got it. Lords Justices is the correct plural of Lord Justice. That's one wrong. Now we've got to get the next three right. Mongoose. Mongoose. The plural of mongoose. Mr. Levant.
I'm going to guess if Mr. Kieran even has a hint, I'd rather give it to him.
Better have it, Mr. Kieran.
Oh, I'll say mongooses.
Mongooses is quite correct.
I would have been wrong. I would have said mongoose.
No, some of these plurals, Mr. Levant, are really very singular.
Never could afford a plural.
That gives us one right. How about notary public? Notary public. Now be careful, gentlemen. Mr. Morley.
Notaries public.
That's right, Mr. Morley. Notaries public. And finally, bison. Bison. B-I-S-O-N, Mr. Kieran.
Bison.
That's right. Right. Plural and singular are exactly the same. That gives us 3 out of 4 and sends us on to a question from D. Ruff of Brooklyn, New York. This is divided into 3 parts. Get 2 out of 3 if you can. If you joined the following groups, what number would you be? In what order would you be? What would you be, 10th or 12th or 5th or 6th or whatever? The first is Raymond Scott's Quintet. If you joined it, you'd be what? Mr. Levant.
I would make the 7th.
You would make the 7th. How do you explain that?
Because he disdains the real meaning of the word quintet. He used to have. As a matter of fact, he has a new band now.
Yeah.
But in those days when he had a quintet, it consisted of 6 men. And he can't count, that's all. You can call it an eccentricity, but he can't count.
Has no one ever told
him how that is, hey?
That's quite right. Mr. Scott's quintet, which still makes records, consists of 6 men. Now, if you joined a group of famous musketeers, I shall not further identify them, what number would you be? Mr. Kieran?
Well, it depends upon whether you mean that D'Artagnan made a 4th, or if you were the extra one, you would make a 5th, because eventually he also joined the 3 Musketeers.
That's right. He was really the extra one, and you would be the 5th if you joined the 3 Musketeers. So what were the names of the 3 Musketeers?
Athos, Porthos, and Aramis.
That's quite right. Very good firm. And the Big Ten. If you joined the Big Ten, Mr. Kieran.
Well, right now you would be the 10th.
Because
Chicago dropped out of conference football.
Yes, that's right. You couldn't name the other 9, could you, by any chance?
Well,
that'd
have
be a tough job.
Come and
Mr. Levant.
I'll do it with John. But we don't care. Everybody knows the Big Ten.
Know all of them?
Yeah, Wisconsin, Northwestern, Ohio State, Indiana. No more Chicago, so don't count that. Minnesota, Purdue. How many have I mentioned?
I don't know. I'm lost.
Good problem.
Michigan.
Very good. That gives us 3 out of 3. Now, gentlemen, here's a question coming from Mrs. William A. Dunks of Seattle, Washington, about England, about the kings of England. Get 3 out of 4. Who was the first Frenchman to become king of England? The first Frenchman to become king of England? Mr. Kieran had his hand up first.
The Norman Conqueror. William the Conqueror.
William the Conqueror. Who was the first Dutchman to become king of England? Mr. Adams.
William of Orange.
William III of Orange, who became joint sovereign with his wife, Mary.
Mary.
Who was the first Dane to become king of England? The first Dane.
You don't mean Hamlet's papa?
No. Hamlet got to England, but I don't think his papa got there. First Dane. The answer is, gentlemen, Mr. Morley?
Could it have been Harold?
No, it was Canute. I think the man who bade the waves be still. Canute. The first Dane. That gives us 1 wrong. And who was the first Scotchman to become king of England? Mr. Morley.
James the 6th of Scotland and the 1st of England.
Yes, James the 1st of England. That gives us 3 out of 4. Well, under all these sovereigns, England seems to have remained England, and I have no doubt she will continue to remain England. The next question comes from Dale Hartman of Grandview, Missouri. This is for Mr. Levant. You other gentlemen may rest, if you will. Get 2 out of 3, Mr. Levant. Identify the compositions from which these counter-melodies are taken and play the main themes. Let's have the first counter-melody. This is Mr. Levant.
That's the last moment of the Mendelssohn Concerto for violin.
That was very easy, wasn't it?
Apparently. No, I didn't play the theme, though.
Gee,
that's that second theme, and later on, the main theme is played against that, I think. You want to try it?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, no. Beat two. All right. One, two. All right. I'm faking.
Doesn't sound like that. Good for you, Mr. Levant. Thank you very much. And now let's have the second, of these compositions, the counter melodies.
It sounds like the Raymond Scott Quintet to me. I don't know.
You just got it on your mind, Mr. Levant.
Well, that's rather tenuous, even whatever it is.
It isn't anything that Raymond Scott does, I don't think.
Well, it isn't anything that has any definite profile of a theme.
Shall I tell you what it is?
Yeah.
It's the piano sonata of Weber's Perpetuo Mobile. Is that what one calls it?
Oh, yeah.
That sounds definite enough, but one wrong only. Now see if you can get the third
and
last.
I can do the main theme, though.
You can?
Yeah, that's
I have no doubt you could. Let's have the third. All right. Now the third and last. Got it?
Yeah, that's just before the coda in the Brahms D major symphony, number 2.
Good enough. And can you give us the melody?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
That's Mr. Levant coming through with his usual brilliance. Thank you very much indeed. And now let's get the whole gang back to work, shall we? Thelma Ritter of Forest Hills, New York, sends this one in. Get 3 out of 4 if you can. Can you tell us what part of a lady is adorned by each of these objects? The first object is a wimple. A wimple? Mr. Kieran.
Wimple would be on her head, hanging, I should think, from her hat, or pinned to her hat, or draped from her hat in some way.
That sounds very picturesque. And what is a wimple exactly, Mr. Kieran?
Well, it's some sort of contraption that hangs down over the chin or around the...
You have the utmost contempt for it, apparently, Mr. Kieran. That's quite right, Mr. Kieran. A wimple is, as you say, some sort of contraption that hangs down. Mr. Morley, could you give us a more apt description of a wimple?
Well, it's a semi-cylindrical subsidiary bag suspended from the top top gallant of the head and somewhat helps to hold up the hair behind.
Funny. You ought to set that to music, Mr. Morley. That's beautiful. That's very good. Now,
it's
gentlemen...
articulated.
That's right. What is or are wedgies? Wedgies. Mr. Morley.
My impression is that they're shoes without any instep.
Without any instep. They have flat bottoms from heel to toe. And they would adorn what part of the lady?
The underside of her soul.
Yes. Her feeties. All right. What, gentlemen, is a chignon? And where does a lady wear it? Mr. Adams.
I think in the era of Goldie's Ladies' Book, it was kind of a hairnet.
Now, I don't go back as far as Goldie's Ladies' Book. I don't think that would be true. I don't think it is a hairnet. Mr. Morley, you seem to be an authority on this sort of thing.
I think it's just a bundle of hair just above the nape at the back of the skull.
Yes, a bundle is perhaps not a very flattering word. let's say a knot. Shall we say a knot of hair gathered at the back of the neck or sometimes the top of the head? That would be a chignon. Now, gentlemen, what is a peplum, and where does the lady wear it? P-E-P-L-U-M, peplum. Mr. Kieran.
A peplum is a dress, a draped garment of a Greek style.
That's right. It is a Greek dress. And where does it begin and where does it end?
Well, I think it begins at the shoulders and it ends at about the knees.
No, I think in old Greek times...
Ends at the ground.
I beg pardon?
Ends at the ground and a little more.
In Greek times, it did go almost all the way down to the ground. But I think nowadays, the ladies wear it beginning at the waist. It's sort of a short, flaring out skirt. Is that phrase that begins at the hips and goes down a little way? Well, that gives us 3 out of 4. Now, so far, we look into the cash drawer and we find that we have lost absolutely nothing and no sets of the encyclopedia. And while you gentlemen are resting on your laurels, Mr. Milton Cross will speak to us.
I chose my wife as she did her wedding gown, not for the fine glossy surface, but for such qualities as would wear well. So writes Goldsmith in The Vicar of Wakefield. Now, we are not suggesting that you choose beverages in the same manner as you would choose a wife, but we certainly think that in making a selection, quality, along with purity and goodness, would be predominant factors. And we think, too, that it is for these reasons that Canada Dry ginger ale, sparkling water, and all Canada Dry beverages are so popular, are ever increasing in popularity. For Canada Dry leaves nothing undone in maintaining the high standards of excellency for which they have become famous. The finest ingredients, blended by experts, always under the watchful supervision of graduate chemists, are the reasons for this high quality, this goodness and purity. So whatever your taste in beverages may be, look for the Canada Dry label. It's your assurance of beverages at their very best.
And, Mr. Cross, you're at your very best and clocked in exactly 60 seconds. Now let's go on with a question from F. Howard of this city. It's a question about football, gentlemen. Here are a group of forward-pass combinations. There are four of them. For what teams do they play? Get three out of four. Here's the first combination. Sagow to Juswick. I got two hands up. We'll start with Mr. Levant. Mr. Kieran had his hand up, too.
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. Maniacci to Famiglietti. Maniacci to Famiglietti. Mr. Levant.
Chicago Bears professional.
Yes, that's quite right, Mr. Levant. O'Brien to Looney. O'Brien to Looney. Mr. Kieran?
Well, the Philadelphia Eagles.
Philadelphia Eagles, also a professional right. team. And the final forward passing combination, Lalonde to Dunkel. Lalonde to Dunkel, I have two hands up again. Suppose you give the first part of the combination, Mr. Levant. Mr. Kieran, give the second.
Lalonde.
And?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. I was going to ask you to say North and have
Kieran
say Carolina. That gives us four out of four. Send us on to a question coming from Peninsula, Ohio, from Paul E. Bennett. Get two out of three, gentlemen, if you can, on this. Name the literary works in which the following dates figure prominently. The first date is April 18th, 1775. In what literary work does that date appear, Mr. Adams?
The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere.
Yes. Can you give us the lines?
Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year.
Yes, the first line the on the 18th of April, in 75. Paul Revere's Ride by Longfellow. Now
that's
the second...
my son Timmy's birthday, too.
That's how you remember it. I'm sure Paul Revere would love to know that, Mr. Adams.
I think he suspects it.
March 15th, 44 B.C. March 15th, 44 B.C. Mr. Morley.
The assassination of Julius Caesar.
Yes, took place on...
The
Ides of March. That's right. Perhaps you remember the lines from Plutarch in which Julius Caesar speaks to the soothsayer when the 15th of March has come. He says, the Ides of March has come, and the soothsayer replies, so be they, but yet are they not past, as Mr. Kieran was just about to say. Now, November 1st, 1855. November 1st, 1855. Mr. Kieran.
The Wonderful One-Horse Shay by Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Collapsed on that date. That's right. That is not an easy date to remember. Do you remember the lines which would recall that to us?
Well, it had something to do with the commemoration.
First of
the
November, Earthquake Day.
Earthquake Day. When Lisbon Town was... when the earth opened up and swallowed Lisbon Town.
That's right. Answered cooperatively by Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran. First of November, 55. This morning, the parson takes a drive. And so forth. That gives us three dates out of three, and so far you gentlemen are unbeatable. Keith Huntress of Urbana, Illinois, sends this one in. Name four books, or more if you wish, the titles of which contain terms used in prize fighting. And give me terms which are more or less germane to prize fighting alone, shall we say. Mr. Kieran.
The Ring and the Book by Robert Browning.
That would be very good. The Ring and the Book by Robert Browning. Mr. Adams, you have that on your mind,
That's
too. Awfully sorry. Mr. Levant.
The Count of Monte Cristo.
Good. Count of Monte Cristo. That's a swell one. That's a very good one. That gives us two. Mr. Kieran?
The Fall of the House of Usher by Poe.
Well, fall, of course. You mean the falling on...
Well, and there are ushers at prize fights.
Oh, yes. Hadn't thought of that. Mr. Morley?
Punch, Brothers, Punch with Care by Mark Twain.
A famous short story. That's very good.
How about Hunch Punch? No.
Hunch Punch and Jowl?
Yeah.
Mr. Levant, another
one? Hemingway book. For Whom the Bells.
For Whom the Bell Tolls. Yes, that would be very good. Roundup by Ring Lauder might be another one. Count Ten, the recent novel by Hans Otto Storm would be another. Well, that gives us four. The Wild Duck by Ibsen, by the way, would be still another.
Very good.
This evening, and for the last few days, a good many of us have been thinking of the way in which our country is divided into states and how the states are arranged and what they look like and how big one is and how small one is. Mrs. Anna Cummings of Emporium, Pennsylvania, sends this one in. What states are separated by these rivers? States having the same name, by the way, as the rivers are excluded. Get two out of three. What states are separated by the Connecticut River? Mr. Adams.
Vermont and New Hampshire.
That's quite right. Vermont and New Hampshire. The Delaware River. What states separated by the Delaware River? Mr. Morley.
Delaware and...
You're not allowed to use the name of the state, which is the same as the river. Mr. Kieran, Mr. Levant, I'm sorry.
Pennsylvania and New Jersey.
Pennsylvania and forms the eastern boundary of Pennsylvania and separates it from New York and New Jersey. That's quite right. Colorado River. Colorado River.
My favorite river.
All right, Mr. Take it, Mr. Levant.
Well, it separates a lot of states from where I saw it. One of them was Nevada, and the other one was Arizona.
Arizona from Nevada, and also Arizona from California at another point in its course.
It's quite a rough river.
You gentlemen apparently know your rivers. Now, the next question comes from Rebecca Simons of Brooklyn, New York. Get three out of four. What do these creatures grow up to be? Here are the four creatures. The first creature is a wriggler. What does a wriggler grow up to be? Mr. Morley.
A mosquito.
A mosquito, that's quite right. Couldn't catch you on that, Mr. Morley. A maggot grows up to be what? A maggot.
A rat.
No, Mr. Levant. A maggot grows up, Mr. Kieran?
A fly.
Yes, an ordinary house fly. A grub grows up to be what? A grub. Mr. Morley.
A caterpillar.
No. No, a grub does not grow up to be a caterpillar.
Or a moth.
No.
What grows up to be a termite?
A grub grows up to be a beetle. A grub grows up to be a beetle. That's one wrong. And a caterpillar, Mr. Morley, grows up to be what?
A butterfly.
Ah, yes. There you are. Well, that gives us three out of four. Now, what can you do with this? Mrs. Charles Harris of Boston, Massachusetts, sends this one in. Identify the swords which are associated in some way with the following objects. Get two out of three. The first is hair, H-A-I-R. H-A-I-R. What sword is associated with hair, Mr. Kieran?
Sword of Damocles.
Sword of Damocles. What's the story?
It's suspended over his head by a hair.
Yes, that's right. Suspended over whose head?
Damocles.
Attaboy. And what sword is associated with stone? With a stone or with stone? Mr. Adams.
Excalibur.
Who was the owner of the sword Excalibur, Mr. Adams?
King Arthur.
King Arthur. What's the story? Roughly.
Oh, you want it in Old English?
No, I'll take Middle English.
He was supposed to pick it out of the stone.
That's right. Anyone who was supposed to be the true king could pick it out of the stone. He was the only one.
Which he done with dispatch.
Helped by dispatch. Who was later knighted and made Sir John Dispatch, I believe, as a result of his efforts. How about silk and down? What sword is associated in your mind with silk and down? Mr. Kieran.
The sword of... Saladin.
That's quite right. What's the story?
In the story of the thing that cured the bomb that cured King Richard. It's in one of Scott's
talisman.
The talisman. Yes. He threw a light down pillow into the air, silken pillow, and to show how sharp this sword was, he cut it in half in the air.
That's right. Exactly right. Not very many people would remember that. See whether you remember this one. This comes from Louis W. Triefenbach of St. Louis, Missouri. Why are Daisy Green, Marjorie Relier, Vaughn Tex Smith, Margaret Walker, Agnes Wayburn, and Marie L. Wilson all grouped together? Mr. Levant.
Are they a softball team?
No, they're not. They may be now. I don't think so. Mr. Levant. Mr. Kieran.
Would that be the Floridora Sextet?
Yes, that's quite right. I know you were kidding, Mr. Levant. They are the original Floridora Sextet. And that does not send $10 or a set of the encyclopedia to Mr. Creason, but sends us on now to Mr. Cross.
Tonight, Canada Dry relinquishes with regret the sponsorship of Information Please. During these 2 years of pleasant association, the makers of Canada Dry have accomplished a number of things which have brought them complete satisfaction. First and most important, of course, They have given you something new in radio entertainment. They've brought scores of celebrated men and women to these microphones. These Canada Dry Talks have been prepared with the thought that the more interesting they were, the more likely you were to listen and thus learn to like Canada Dry beverages. And Mr. Fadiman has timed my messages so that we would never be tempted to destroy the spontaneity of the program with interruptions that were too lengthy. In other words, we've wanted information, please, to be just as pleasant and lively as a glass of Canada Dry. And now, on behalf of Canada Dry, I want to thank all of you for your part in making this program possible. Your loyalty to Canada Dry has been extremely gratifying. Even though Canada Dry bows out of the picture with this broadcast, Information, Please will continue its merry way on another network on Friday evenings. And we sincerely hope that you will continue to listen to Information, Please and to continue to enjoy it.
Mr. Cross, members of the great organization of Canada Dry, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the audience, what I say now goes for all of the Information, Please staff. It goes for John Kieran and Franklin P. Adams and Oscar Levant and Mr. Dan Golan-Paul, the creator of the program. We've had a very good time working with Canada Dry, and we say that in all sincerity and all that in all sincerity and all that in all sincerity and all that in all nutshell, we see no particular reason why all of us, including our listeners, shouldn't go right, Information, Please, terminates its association with that excellent product this evening. No matter what our future fortunes may be, good or bad, there'll always be a warm spot in our hearts for our first sponsor, Canada Dry. And I hope there'll always be a spot in your refrigerator for the finest of carbonated beverages. And so, Canada Dry, so long, and we end with the cheerful thought that this evening you do not have to pay out any $10 bills or any Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, but on Friday the 15th, that's a week from this Friday and over another network, Information, Please will make its first appearance under a new sponsor. At that time, we will have with us the veteran Adams, Kieran, and Levant combination, and as our very extra, extra special guest, a great humorist, who many people, both in and out of radio, consider the greatest master of ad-libbing in the business. Ladies and gentlemen, next week, we offer you Fred Allen, the star of the Texaco Theater in person. As for your letters with questions and the correct answers, please address them this week to Information, Please, at 1 Pershing Square, New York City. And now, good night to all, and to all, the best of good fortune.